Hello, this is Alton Banks from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Well, we'll begin this week's Triangle Business Journal as we normally do on the biz page. And under the heading of Cool Customers comes the article, Mebane Tattoo Shop Gets Some Unexpected Guests. Biz loves it when things just come together, and that's how a small tattoo shop in Mebane inked some of the biggest stars in college basketball. Karen McHugh, owner of Cardinal Skin Art and Gallery, calls it serendipitous the way the shop came to tattoo UNC Chapel Hill standouts Kobe White, Nasser Little, Leaky Black, and Garrison Brooks. McHugh tells Biz he and his fiancée, Celeste, were on the way home from vacation the day after the Tar Heels lost in the NCAA tournament, decided to take in a flick in Chapel Hill. As the couple was grabbing some popcorn, they spotted White, then realized Little and Black were also there. Being huge UNC fans, they made an introduction, found out the three had been scouring Instagram for a tattoo artist to offer more than the studios in town. Bingo! The next day, White and Black were in McHugh's Mebane shop. The day after, Little came in to get his tattoo. Brooks came in a day later. It has been an overwhelmingly positive experience, McHugh says. It's been our pleasure working with them and getting to know them a little better. And under the heading of Noted comes the article, Report Gives Raleigh and Charlotte High Marks for Solar. Raleigh and Charlotte were just named among the top U.S. cities for solar energy in a new report by Environment North Carolina Research and Policy Center. The study put Charlotte at 27th and Raleigh at 33rd when it comes to total solar energy capacity. In terms of megawatts of solar energy capacity per capacity, Raleigh ranked at 37, topping Charlotte, which came in 41st. Leading the list was Honolulu. With three cities on the West Coast, San Diego was number 2, San Jose number 3, and Las Vegas number 5. Also near the top, ranking at number 4, was Burlington, Vermont. And under the heading of Back in the Playoffs, hurricanes are on the list, but at least the misery is over for this year. So, ESPN has updated its Sports Misery Index. Before you ask, it's a ranking index of the most miserable fan bases in sports, and one Triangle team is on the list. The misery formula includes several factors such as championships, playoff berths, playoff wins, heartbreaks, and rival comparison. The higher the number, the more misery exists, so here's a hint. Fans of the NBA's Sacramento Kings, 27.1 points. The MLB's San Diego Padres, 25.51, and the NFL's Buffalo Bills, 25.24, are the three most miserable in the country, says ESPN. And one local team is among the 20 most miserable, coming in at, well, number 20. With a 16.65 index score, the Carolina Hurricanes fan base is still reeling from years without a playoff appearance. But there is good news. With a return to the playoffs this year, the folks at ESPN are optimistic the Triangle's only professional sport team will drop off the misery index completely come fall. Oh, and the Charlotte Hornets were number 17 on the list with a misery index of 16.95. And under the heading of Moving Up comes the article, U.S. News Confirms the Triangle is Back in the Top 10. After 2 years of slipping, the Triangle is back on the rise in the annual rankings of best places to live by U.S. News and World Report. The Triangle jumped 3 slots, and other North Carolina cities were lauded as well. The Triangle checked in at number 10 after ranking 13 last year. The region ranked number 7 in 2017 and number 4 in 2016. While all rankings are subjective, the new report underscores the growing appeal of the Triangle. Asheville jumped to number 16 after being number 24 a year ago. Also ranked are Charlotte, number 20, Winston-Salem, number 31, and Greensboro at 66. And under the heading of Long Time comes the article, Time for a North Carolinian to Win the Masters Green Jacket. The Masters is back underway at Augusta National this week with Raleigh native Webb Simpson in the field. Simpson is ranked number 23 in the world and raked in $128,150 last year when he tied for 20th at the Masters. But despite North Carolina's remarkable golf heritage, few products of the state have won the green jacket. Mark O'Meara was born in Goldsboro in 1957 and won the Masters in 1998. But O'Meara grew up in Southern California and played at Long Beach State. The only Masters winner with deep ties to the state was Ray Floyd, who grew up in Fayetteville and won the tournament in 1976. Two products of North Carolina colleges did win it. Art Wall, Jr., a Duke University graduate, won the Masters in 1959. And, of course, Arnold Palmer came from La Trobe, Pennsylvania, to play at Wake Forest College. He won the Masters in 1958, 1960, 1962, and 1964. Finally, on the biz page, under the heading of New Option, comes the article, Fast Food Concept is Coming to the Triangle on a Truck. If you start seeing the shell of a restaurant on the back of a truck, it's because a Florida company with a national presence is looking to ramp up in the Triangle. Checkers and Rally's, a Tampa-based company formed by a merger in 1999, plans to expand in North Carolina. Director of Franchise Development, Robert Benguidat, tells Biz the company currently has 874 restaurants, but only 8 in North Carolina. We see a fit for about 45 to 50 restaurants in the state, he says. Benguidat says about a third of the restaurants are corporate-owned, but the goal is to find investors to drive growth here. We've had lots of interest, but we're looking for people with the capacity to open more than one to accelerate the growth strategy, he says. That means targeting investors with a net worth of north of $750,000, and especially with a restaurant background. One way Checkers controls costs is by building the shell of the restaurant in Florida and shipping it to the location. This building is actually impressive. When people hear modular building, they think of a trailer home. Our building is 60,000 pounds with steel beams, Benguidat says. The buildings are 1,000 square feet and drive-through only. That allows Checkers to manage costs and still provide a steady stream of revenue. He says annual sales across the board are about $1 million, with new restaurants averaging about $1.25 million in sales. Profits can exceed $200,000. The concept targets college students, which the Triangle has plenty. They snack multiple times throughout the day, he says, and the late night is really appealing. Next, we turn to the Tech Transportation Legal page, and under the heading of Warehouse District comes the article, New Bus Hub Sought for Raleigh. Transit leaders have a bold vision for what they're calling the Raleigh Union Station Bus Facility, a transformative mixed-use project planned for the Warehouse District. Weeks after rallying developers with a 39-page request for qualifications, called an RFQ, Regional Transit Agency GO Triangle has heard back from 7 companies interested in developing the site, GO Triangle General Manager Jeff Mann says. Mann envisions a world-class multimodal campus that further connects Union Station to the region, accommodating multiple transit options, from the buses and trains currently serving Raleigh to future rail lines and bus rapid transit. It will improve the quality of life by improving mobility, he says. And, as stated in the RFQ, the site represents a prime development opportunity for the right company. The optimal development partner is an experienced team that can successfully deliver a mixed-use development program that's vertically integrated with a new bus terminal on the RUS bus site, the RFQ notes. And the developer will have help, as GO Triangle was recently awarded a $20 million U.S. Department of Transportation grant to support the facility's development. The scope and the price tag of the project is unknown. While Go Triangle has begun engineering and design work, the winning developer will craft much of the plans for the space. Mann won't say who those potential partners are. Mike Munn, CEO of McAdams, predicts a blend of companies being involved, from local firms, other developers intrigued by the region and the growth of the region. The transit element is unlike anything most Triangle real estate developers have encountered. For that reason, he says he wouldn't be surprised to see a joint venture emerge, a combination of local players and outside developers. And under the heading of Russian ties, the article, Raleigh Project Takes Off Despite Federal Charges Against Investors. As federal officials build their money laundering case against a Russian couple in Raleigh, a real estate project they funneled cash into is moving forward. Leonid and Tatiana Teff were indicted last year following the FBI raid on their Northridge home. Leonid Teff was accused of orchestrating a two-year kickback scheme, funneling money from Russia military defense contracts, and skimming more than $150 million. In the meantime, court documents show one of their real estate investments may be preparing to take off, the Windcrest subdivision in North Raleigh. A judge recently finalized an order requiring the federal government to return more than $760,000 that had been seized so that an entity known as Link Ventures could complete the project. The Teffs could not be reached for comment. Their attorney, Benjamin Layton of Moore and Van Allen, didn't return an inquiry to comment. The project is one of multiple recent investments the Teffs made in the Triangle with a company called Blue Sky Services. In addition to buying a two-story historic building on East Target Street last year, the Teffs partnered with Blue Sky on the Windcrest subdivision. The Blue Sky website describes it as a $15.3 million project with 17 luxury estate homes. It's reaching a critical phase for investors, as court's documents show. Link has identified more than one potential buyer, represented by Jim Allen Group. Blue Sky executives wouldn't answer questions about the project April 9th, but Nikita Zhitov, broker in charge, did email a statement touting the project's success. The Windcrest subdivision project is progressing as planned, he states. We're in the last phases of the project. We anticipate completing development of the subdivision and preparing for the sale of the lots in approximately 30 days. And under the heading of Adding Capacity, the article, Port of Wilmington Gets New Crane as Part of Upgrades. North Carolina Port's third Neo-Panamax crane, part of a $33.8 million purchase, just arrived at the Port of Wilmington. The cranes add up to a fraction of a $200 million capital improvement plan, which also include construction of a wider turning basin, berth enhancements, and a container terminal overhaul. Joan Molesky, who heads the Department of Maritime Administration at Texas A&M University in Galveston, Texas, says investment in cranes are all about throughput. The faster you can unload a ship and get the cargo out to the hinterlands outside the port, the shipping companies look at that and say, great, if you can do that faster, better, cheaper, then I'm more likely to come to your port, she explains. She says equipment investments like this one are only worth the investment if the port has a consistent, sufficient volume to justify that level of automation. The North Carolina Ports Authority has not responded to multiple requests for comment on its operations. In a news release, the authority predicts the renovations will double the port's annual throughput capacity to 1.2 million TEUs, or 20-foot equivalent units. And finally, on this page, under the heading of Aviation, comes the article, Colorado Firm Expects Big Demand for Hangar Space. Colorado-based Western LLC is finalizing plans for what's expected to be a massive 48-acre corporate hangar complex at Raleigh-Durham International Airport. Brad Henderson, CEO of the Airport Construction and Design Build Company, says demand for the facility is high. I'm really impressed with the demand, he says. It's really turned out that we have some real tenants looking for larger facilities, which fits us perfectly. Phase one, at least right now, appears to cater to that pent-up demand from primarily jet management companies and maintenance repair firms, he says. It's their feedback that's influencing the design of the first basic facilities that will be built on the campus. But it's phase two where Henderson and his team try to leverage the campus to recruit new players that could have the biggest economic development potential. Henderson plans to sell the community to big-name players. His team plans to recruit at industry conferences and even internationally, talking up the area to companies needing hangar space. Next, we turn to the On Healthcare and Education page of the Triangle Business Journal. And under the heading of Executive Shuffle comes the article, Chimerix taps former Endocyte executive as CEO. Following the sudden departure of its last CEO earlier this year, Chimerix has tapped a pair of Endocyte executives to lead the company. The Durham-based biopharmaceutical company named Michael Sherman CEO. Formerly, Sherman led Endocyte. In addition to Sherman, the company has also named former Endocyte Chief Financial Officer Michael Andriole to the newly created position of Chief Business Officer. This pair has a proven track record of successfully developing valuable clinical assets, and we believe Chimerix will significantly benefit from the strategic and operational experience that they will bring the company, said Martha Dembski, chair of the Chimerix Board of Directors. Sherman will be filling the hole left by the sudden departure of former CEO Dr. Michelle Berry in February. Sherman served as CEO of Endocyte until its acquisition by Novartis in December for $2.1 billion. And under the heading of Disruptive Innovation comes the article, NC State Claims Breakthrough in AI Research. New research out of NC State University claims to improve AI learning speeds by as much as 60%, presenting massive opportunities in the AI industry and for the researchers planning to commercialize it. On April the 11th, researchers at NC State presented the findings of a groundbreaking technique that reduces training time for deep learning networks, a tantalizing possibility for technologies such as face recognition or self-driving cars that need to sift through endless amounts of data. Xiping Chen, a professor of computer science at NC State and co-author of a paper on the work, says the ramifications of the method are massive and could greatly accelerate development in the AI industry. One of the biggest challenges facing the development of new AI tools is the amount of time and computing power it takes to train deep learning networks to identify and respond to the data patterns that are relevant to their applications, he says. We've come up with a way to expedite that process, which we call adaptive deep reuse. We have demonstrated that it can reduce training times by up to 69% without accuracy loss. Shen says they are still working with the university's technology transfer office to secure the intellectual property rights, but are looking to commercialize it after receiving interest from the industry. He says they do not know whether they plan to just license the concept to companies or whether they plan to launch a spin-out company of their own. The method works by teaching the AI to identify patterns in sets of data that it is analyzing instead of repeatedly analyzing millions and millions of bits of data. The network can apply filters to one chunk of data and apply the results to similar data sets, saving time and computing power. The researchers tested their technique using three deep learning networks and data sets that are widely used as test beds by deep learning researchers. SafariNet using Safari 10, AlexNet using ImageNet, and VCG19 using ImageNet. The technique cut training time for AlexNet by 69%, for VGG19 by 68%, and for SafarNet by 63%, all without accuracy loss. This technology is directly deployable to the current frameworks, Shen says, so it's ready to be used in an industry that needs AI solutions. Also under this page comes the under the headline of Preparing for Growth, comes the article Veritas Continues Bulking Up C-Suite for Planned Expansion Strategy. Executives at Veritas Collaborative are saying the company is planning an aggressive growth strategy throughout the Southeast United States, and in preparation, the company continues to bulk up its C-suite. Just days after announcing the hire of a new company president to serve alongside its CEO, Durham's Veritas Collaborative has added a chief growth officer position to its executive team. According to the company, Julie Holland has been hired to serve in the CGO role. Holland most recently worked as a senior vice president of international relations for the Eating Recovery Center in Denver. Prior to that, Holland served as vice president of business development, eating disorders programs for CRC Health. She received her master's degree in health science with an emphasis in counseling from Georgia Southern University, and her bachelor's degree in psychology from Armstrong State College. Julie and I have a long-standing professional relationship, as we have worked with and around each other for a number of years, said Stacy McIntyre, founder and CEO of Veritas. I know her to be both strategic and creative, which is exactly what this role requires. She has committed her career to creating thoughtful experiences to put compassionate, effective, best practice care at the forefront. We have confidence that the Veritas brand will thrive with her at the helm. Holland's first task is launching Veritas as a national brand through an aggressive marketing plan. I've dedicated my professional career to working with behavioral health and specifically with the eating disorders population, Holland says. Earlier this month, the company announced Michael Browder as its new president, who is tasked with running day-to-day operations and growth while McIntyre explores acquisition and expansion opportunities in other markets. And finally on this page, under the heading of Hiring Spree, comes the article, Virginia Company Looks to Quadruple Its Triangle Ops. A recent nod from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has one Charlottesville, Virginia company eyeing big expansion in the Triangle, looking to quadruple its headcount and invest $10 million in the coming years. Timothy Fisher, president and CEO of the company, said that the most recent FDA authorization for its analyzer machine is huge for the company, opening up nearly 70% of the global market. He said the company plans to start shipping its product across the U.S. within weeks to customers. To fill that new market and subsequent orders, Fisher said the company is looking to bolster its headcount and consolidate its Triangle operations. Currently, the company maintains a research and development facility in downtown Durham and a smaller production site off Stirrup Creek Drive in Durham. In the coming months, he said the company plans to make a move to a 45,000-square-foot facility in Research Triangle Park, though the company has yet to sign the lease. Build-out for the facility will be done in stages over the course of several years, but Fisher said he expects the total investment to come out to about $10 million, with the company's headcount expanding from 50 to 200 in the same time frame. In 2019, he expects the staff to double. Next, we turn to the restaurants and retail page of this week's Triangle Business Journal, and under the heading of Openings and Closings comes the article, Tavern Arrives, Tyler's Tap Room Bids Adieu in Durham. Charlotte-based Hickory Tavern, an ESPN two-time finalist for Best Sports Bar in North America, will open its 28th restaurant in Marshall this May. In preparation for the grand opening, the tavern is looking to bring approximately 100 new jobs to the Marshall area. We're looking to hire fun, caring, and driven team members with a hospitality mindset to join our Hickory Tavern Farm, says General Manager Mark Kaswamy. Longtime American Tobacco Campus restaurant Tyler's Tap Room will close its doors for good on April the 19th. Its 14-year run at American Tobacco will leave a huge hole in the history of the Bull City, but work is underway to find other options to fill the space. ATC has now hired CBRE to help lead a strategy designed to bring a new restaurant to the location. American Tobacco Campus is a rare, truly authentic mixed-use project that launched the transformation of downtown Durham, says Charlie Coyne, Senior Vice President and Director of CBRE. We're very fortunate to join this team at a pivotal point in its future. The partnership with CBRE comes ever as the campus plans its largest ever expansion at the University Ford Kia location next door. And under the heading of Warehouse District comes the article, The Flourish Market Gets New Digs and a New Concept. From Wall Street to the streets of Raleigh, Emily Sexton has looked to deliver a sense of enthusiasm and wit that influences women. Now she's expanding her shop, the Flourish Market, when it moves from 713 Tucker Street in Glenwood South to a new location in the Warehouse District. The new location, which she expects to open by the end of May, will more than triple the size at 3,500 square feet and will feature more dressing rooms as well as more clothing, jewelry, and accessories. It will also include children's clothing and home decor. Our design plans, created by our wonderful local designer, Allison Briggs, includes dressing rooms, a storage area, and a unique display wall on the left when you enter the shop, a creative design I've never seen anywhere, she says. The Flourish Market will feature a co-working space with a choose-your-seat-through-the-day work environment. Whether you want to sit at a traditional desk, a high-top bar table, a cozy chair or couch, you'll be sure to find the perfect spot, Sexton says. In the center, she plans a coffee lounge. I've always been so inspired by the women I've met through my travels in the developing world and how they are committed to taking time to stop and connect with other women over a cup of coffee or tea, she says. The lounge will be a serve-yourself, donation-based system with donations going to local nonprofits. Events in the space will include potluck dinners, mother-daughter events for moms of teen girls, fireside chats with authors, yoga classes, watercolor art classes, and more. Sexton will also launch a female entrepreneur collaborative. When I think of what our city and state would look like when women truly connect, feel less alone in their struggles, and are supported in the community, I see a future where we are in an unstoppable force for good. All memberships in the collaborative will be part-time. The price will start at $195 a month and include dedicated parking, monthly socials, and business training classes. Now we've reached the cover story of this week's Triangle Business Journal, and that cover story is entitled He Powers Duke's Footprint in Durham. Longfellow Real Estate Partners began planning its first new project in downtown Durham with a single building in mind for a property on Morris Street. Then Scott Selig stepped in. Selig is Duke University's Associate Vice President of Capital Assets and Real Estate, a title that puts him in charge of the school's leases and real estate deals across the triangle. He's wielded that power the past 17 years to help reshape Durham's urban core. Duke, led by Selig, has used leases to spur development rather than property acquisitions and construction equipment. On Morris Street, that strategy resulted in two buildings, where previously there had been plans for just one. When Selig sat down with Longfellow 3 years ago to talk about their new Morris Street building, part of the larger downtown Durham Innovation District, or Durham ID, Selig told the firm that Duke would lease the entire space. But he had one request, that Longfellow develop another building next door. Today, both buildings are complete, marking the first new construction at Durham ID. Duke Clinical Research Institute moved into all 160,000 square feet of the first building in December. At the second, Longfellow has already lined up a lease of more than 80,000 square feet with co-working provider WeWork. universities across the country have stepped up real estate investments in their communities by buying and developing properties, both as investments and as ways to control the communities around them. But Duke has used a different technique to play an outsized role in Durham's revitalization. Steered by Selig, Duke has used its financial heft to lease large chunks of office and lab space and rehabbed tobacco warehouses and new office buildings. Duke's leases have been designed to give developers the commitment needed to finance projects, and the strategy has been a key component in much of Durham's major commercial downtown projects of the last decade. Two decades ago, the Gothic structures and manicured lawns of Duke felt disconnected from a city with a gritty feel to it, with rusting buildings and abandoned tobacco warehouses pocked with weeds. And that gap was only highlighted by the Duke lacrosse case of 2006, which brought national attention to the school and town and the significant divides between the two involving class and race. But the Durham of a decade ago seems hard to imagine now, as the city has exploded with new jobs and new buildings, and streets that were once empty at night are now full of people going to plays, to pubs, and to a vibrant restaurant scene. And Duke has been a quiet force behind the changes. Their role is so much bigger than just taking space and putting bodies there, says Jessica Brock, a partner at Longfellow and the person who sat opposite Selig on the Morris Street negotiations. As Selig points out, the changes helped Durham, and Duke as well. It's also about attracting the best faculty, staff, and students in the world. We're in fierce competition every day, he notes. We have to have a great place for them to live, not just work. In recent months, because of the botched 17-mile Durham Orange Light Rail project, some Durham officials have vociferously called out Duke, stating one of the world's most prominent universities do not control what the city needs or wants. Duke officials have largely stayed away from engaging with the community with equal vigor and have suggested the university is willing to once again engage in light rail conversations when a new concept comes to focus. But despite the recent controversy, Duke's influence and relevance to Durham is unquestionable, and Selig has been on the forefront of most of it. A map of Durham covers an entire wall of Selig's office at the American Tobacco campus. From above, the university's footprint on the eastern edge of town appears larger than all of downtown Durham and the surrounding streets. But within those blocks, Duke now has a university's worth of offices and operations. That includes a wide range of offices from the Duke Innovation and Entrepreneurship Initiative to the Duke Molecular Physiology Institute. But that wasn't always the case. Former Downtown Durham Inc. CEO Bill Kalkoff remembers Selig's move to Duke as a turning point for the university's role and the development of the city's urban core. When Selig came on board, he and Executive Vice President Tolman Trask became the main points of contact for developers interested in working with the university. It was hard to figure out when I was first hired, who exactly do you talk to at Duke to get Duke interested, Kalkoff says. When Tolman and Scott came along, you had these point guys, and you knew who to talk to. Trask had previously served in a similar role at the University of Washington, but moved to Duke in 1995. Selig worked with Trask at the university in Seattle. As a graduate of the Fuqua School of Business, Selig jumped at the opportunity to join Trask and returned to Duke in 2001. That same year, Capital Broadcasting Company bought a former tobacco manufacturing site that had been shut down more than a decade earlier. Capital Broadcasting spent several years working on a deal to redevelop the property into what is now known as the American Tobacco Campus. A critical component of the deal was landing tenants to occupy the future rehabilitated space. That was Duke's first significant play downtown. It all traces back to American Tobacco, Kalkoff says. The first major tenants at American Tobacco were CompuWare, GlaxoSmithKline, and Duke. That combination led enough square footage to be leased to put enough funding together for American Tobacco. For Duke, its presence at the campus was just the beginning. By the time the waves of publicity hit with the Duke lacrosse case, Duke's influence was already quietly beginning to build. In fact, Selig says, Duke had just purchased 13 houses around East Campus from a local landlord with plans to fix them up and thus improve the neighborhood a mere 3 weeks before the charges against the lacrosse players. In fact, one of the homes bought was the site of the lacrosse party. Duke demolished that house on Buchanan Boulevard in 2010. But otherwise, the school has steadily helped the city build. The Carmichael Building on North Duke Street was built in the 1920s, but by 2012, the complex was mostly empty, except for an aging social services office. But where many saw a building that was well past its usable lifespan, Selig envisioned cutting-edge lab space. He got the university to sign a lease with landlord Longfellow for 115,000 square feet before it was redeveloped. Today, Duke researchers spend their days poring over in high-end lab space on both floors of the building. When the air conditioning is turned off on the weekends, the sweet smell of cured tobacco emanates from the exposed wood beams of the ceiling. But the building otherwise has a look and feel of a cutting-edge research facility. For Selig, Duke's investment in the city's core are paid back in the form of employee recruitment and retention. By helping to bring Durham into the 21st century, Duke is at the same time creating a city that can compete with talent with tech hubs in California and the Northeast, Selig says. All the employees working downtown support a rich ecosystem of restaurants and bars, such as the new Urban Axes location on Foster Street, where patrons can chuck a hatchet at a Target while sipping an IPA. I can guarantee you there's not another town of 300,000 people with an axe-throwing bar, Selig says. Duke's decision to lease rather than build opens room for more kinds of businesses to fill space downtown, creating a diversity of companies and employees. That makes for a more interesting and compelling urban core, Selig says. From the perspective of economic developers, it was also better to have Duke lease space for tax reasons. If the university bought, developed, and owned properties, the city would be losing property tax revenue because of the school's nonprofit status. We were not looking for them to build anything because that would take that property off the tax rolls, Kalkoff says. Having Duke in buildings throughout downtown also made Kalkoff's job easier when it came to persuading investors and business owners. During the many downtown tours that Kalkoff gave to developers and companies, he would cite Duke's footprints in terms of square footage and employee count, which now exceeds 1 million and 4,000 respectively. You can't buy that kind of marketing, Kalkoff says. Durham developer Anthony Dillweg, a former Duke quarterback who is CEO of the Dillweg Companies, is well aware of the impact Duke has had on the city and calls the relationship between the city and the university really important. In my experience, they seem to have a vision and the courage to go to areas a lot of other people don't want to go, he says. Dillweg notes that Selig has a role that straddles multiple responsibilities, working to find locations that work for a wide variety of Duke entities within a city that is evolving at a brisk pace. Scott's got a lot of different groups to work with and meet their needs, Dillweg says. That's a unique responsibility. I beg your pardon. That's a unique position and a lot of responsibility. Selig has a preferred phrase for the current state of downtown Durham's development. It's the end of the beginning, he says. The old tobacco warehouses have mostly all been rehabilitated and are on their way to being fully occupied. Office vacancy downtown now sits at just 7%. The next stage in the growth of downtown will be attracting major corporate users, companies willing to relocate from as close as Raleigh or as far as the West Coast, Selig says. He expects that growth to happen naturally in the coming years, but it will require new development to accommodate the new companies. Duke's level of involvement in those hypothetical future projects remains to be seen. Selig sees the university's role downtown slowing down. In his view, downtown has arrived and is exerting its own gravitational pull that doesn't necessarily require new to anchor new projects. An example of these forces already at play can be seen across the street from the Durham Bulls Athletic Park, where the 555 Mangum office building has been rising since last year. At 10 stories, the office building isn't necessarily redefining the city's skyline, but it is showing that developers are willing to bet on a future of downtown Durham without having the guarantee of a Duke lease. And that's fine by Salick. A downtown Duke would be boring, he says. But he expects the connection between Duke and the city core to only grow. Our incoming freshmen have many of their events downtown, Salick says. That was unthinkable 15 years ago. But now, he says, Duke and downtown Durham are inextricably linked. Frequent listeners to Triangle Business Journal will know that after the cover story, we typically cover the executive voice, and so we will this week. This week's executive voice belongs to Dr. Michael Waldrum. Vidant Health is one of the largest healthcare providers in the state, and its flagship hospital in Greenville ranks fifth in size for hospitals in North Carolina. With that scale comes the range of high-end specialties and equipment one would expect. But its CEO, Dr. Michael Waldrum, says one of the primary patient pools is the rural counties of eastern North Carolina, which remain largely underserved and lack access to essential care. As the new chair of the North Carolina Healthcare Association, Waldrum says one of his main priorities is finding ways to increase access to rural counties while still balancing costs and demand in more populated areas. So in an interview, Waldrum explains how a goal as simple as offering adequate medical care for all North Carolinians is challenging, with high-demand specialists often reluctant to move into low-demand areas. So here's the Q&A with Waldrum. What's your priority as NCHA chair? The biggest thing is telling the great story of what the healthcare providers and hospitals do for the citizens of North Carolina. And all the rhetoric and messaging, there's this kind of negative story out there. But healthcare is a great thing. Professionals helping other people at the time of their most significant need. So what are the biggest changes ahead? The biggest transformation is how the providers and hospitals are getting a lot closer with our communities on how we're driving healthy behaviors and try to help people not get sick. Getting our payers aligned to help our doctors and nurses do that kind of work is really the transition we're going through. How do we prevent people from showing up with advanced cancers and finding them earlier and preventing cardiovascular disease? It's really an exciting time because it's a partnership. And so the transition is going from healthcare, taking care of people once they're sick and showing up at our doors, to leading people to live healthier, more meaningful lives. So how do you balance the needs of urban and rural areas? There are a number of unique and important issues that hopefully our policymakers, and really our citizens, can kind of understand, because when you divide solutions, they're different in rural environments than they are in urban environments. I have hospitals currently in both, and I have managed systems with very large urban hospitals and also rural systems. There are structural differences. In the rural environments, there tend not to be as many resources. Typically, there's only one system, or one provider, or few providers in a smaller community. Then in some rural environments, you have a shrinking market, so less people. But there are still people there. Policymakers lose track of that sometimes when we talk about the urbanization of America. There are still these people left behind, so we can't just forget about them out in these communities. For example, some OBGYN services in rural environments are really difficult because the volume is where maybe you have one baby per day. To have the doctors and the nurses and infrastructure to do that, you don't make any money in any company with that kind of volume. But it's really important to the community. If a hospital closes OBGYN GYN services, then the town actually starts to go away. What solutions are there? The answer is obviously complex. As a system, we'll support services in the region that are important to maintain our mission because we're a mission-driven organization. During this transformation, specifically in behavioral health and opioid issues, having insurance covering lives with Medicaid is part of the solution. It's clear in the states that have expanded Medicaid that the most significant intervention is to have people covered so that they can be treated for the disease they have. Getting those into a disease management process is important. We look at a lot of different ways. We talk a lot about systems of care here, understanding the population and understanding the issues that people in those populations have, then tailoring the resources to the specific needs at the lowest cost to provide access. It's finding out how we can use technologies to add capabilities that, frankly, we didn't have just a few years ago to stretch geography and expand those services out into the region. So, what are some of the positive trends in healthcare? At Vitant Health, just like the other major providers in North Carolina and the country, we are putting in systems to prevent people from needing acute care and services, and so keeping people at home and healthier longer. There are many, many examples of how we do that, prompting healthy lifestyles and health coaches, identifying diseases early so we can cure them rather than when they're not curable. All of that takes a lot of data infrastructure to understand the population and the people, and then target to the individual. So all this analytic work and predicting who's going to need care and intervening earlier with health coaches and nutritionists and doctors and nurses to keep people healthier longer. That's really exciting work. And when literally you see it working and you talk to the people that we put in these systems and now their diabetes is cured, those kinds of things are very meaningful and impactful for our work. Finally, what motivates you? Really helping people and trying to create an environment in which our patients, families, team members, and physicians can be excellent and fulfill their drive to have fulfilling lives. It all comes down to why I went into healthcare as a physician and administrator. It's to help people. That's a great way to spend your life. And in the small business column this week comes the article, Competition in a Family Business Can Be Healthy in the Long Run. The great truths seem to have a short shelf life these days. Many of life's principles have gone right into the drink. An example is the old saw about working hard and making an honest profit. But in a business-owning family, some truths are as natural as mosquitoes at a cookout. For example, love and money struggle for dominance. One family member says, this company's the springboard from which my kids will jump to a better life. Another says, I'll think warm, fuzzy thoughts with you when this business has provided me all the money I want, but not before. But a fat paycheck's not always the real compensation sought by family members in the business. Many crave recognition and approval from one another more than salaries and perks. Still, children naturally seek to differentiate themselves from their parents. The older generation tries to teach the younger and to model behaviors and perspectives for them to follow. Children are different from their parents, and the differences can surface in important, if frustrating, ways. There's a natural progression in how children relate to their parents as they both mature. It moves from unquestioning devotion to the recognition of imperfection into out-and-out competition. A family company that's dominated by a few people who are never usually confronted by others usually doesn't have very strong continuity prospects. Someone usually rises to the top. It's not an uncommon scenario. Succession planning stalls when the ranks of the younger generation don't produce an obvious candidate for next head of the business, but the wise family leader hangs in there. If the teaching and learning have been good, if commitment has been nurtured, if family dynamics are encouraging, then a solid young person usually emerges. More often than not, that person capably leads the family, company, into the future. Sometimes you just have to be patient. Now we turn to the back page of this week's Triangle Business Journal, and there's the guest editorial, as always, entitled Tax Policy. This is written by Isabel Sawhill, who happens to be a senior fellow of economic studies at the Center of Children and Families at the Brookings, and by her co-worker, Christopher Pulliam, who's a research assistant at that center. Many people are busy filing their taxes for income earned in 2018. It can be a painful process. It's not just that it's hard to give up the money that one thought one had earned. The rules are so complex that even those of us with advanced degrees in economics aren't always sure which way is up. The new tax law enacted in 2017 helped a little in this regard, at least, by expanding the standard deduction and so reducing the number of people for whom itemizing deductions makes sense. Although many other provisions, especially for business, added to the complexity. One way to simplify matters would be to enact a value-added tax, or VAT. This last idea is especially worthy in our view. First, it would raise a lot of revenue in a transparent, simple fashion. It could, if desired, replace the income tax for everyone earning less than a six-figure income. April 15th, for the 125 million taxpayers in this category, would then, to quote Yale law professor Michael Graetz, become just another spring day. It would reduce the anxiety of most middle-class families caused by the uncertainty of how much tax they will owe, and perhaps their fear that they are missing out on some deduction that other people are getting. Second, we know a VAT works. Why? Because every other Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development member country has one. Third, it would be more efficient and more growth-oriented than the income tax, encouraging saving among today's young adults who are putting aside less of their income than previous generations. Finally, it could be border-adjusted, potentially making American goods more competitive in global markets. But would a VAT be fair? The answer is that it can be if, one, we retain an income tax for the most affluent, for example, people earning more than $100,000. Two, the reformed law includes exemptions for certain necessities, such as groceries, rent, and medical care. And three, we use some of the revenues to compensate lower-income households for the higher prices everyone would have to pay. Gale wants to use most of the revenues to reduce deficits, a worthy goal for sure, but one that conflicts with trading off against lower income taxes, thus making it more politically attractive. This brings to the biggest issue of all, could a VAT ever be enacted? Granted, that's the hard part. Larry Summers said it best. Liberals think it's regressive, and conservatives think it's money a machine. He went on to suggest we could get a VAT when liberals realize it's a money machine and conservatives realize it's regressive. It's worth noting in this context that many Republicans have embraced a VAT. It's just they've called it something different. Senator Ted Cruz, for example, called it a business transfer tax during the 2016 debates. And a number of Republicans advocated a cash flow tax. That's a variation of a VAT. In the debates leading up to the enactment of the 2017 law. On the left, many Democrats have no problem with regressive taxes, so long as the benefits they provide are progressive. Social Security payroll taxes are a case in point. Surveys and focus groups suggest that many Americans support flat taxes, and a VAT is a first cousin of a flat tax. The important point is that labels and messages matter. Imagine a 2020 presidential candidate saying, I promise that if I'm elected, I will eliminate your income taxes if you make less than $100,000 a year. Admittedly, prices would be higher under a VAT, but as behavioral research has shown, context matters. You might pay a little more for a new TV, a cell phone, or a living room chair, but you're getting something you want in return. That's a subjectively different experience than getting a W-2 in the mail, showing how much of your hard-earned money has gone to the government, with nothing very tangible to show for it, a perception heightened by growing distrust in government. Instead, all you're getting on April 15th is a variety of headaches and worries, depending on your circumstances. Should you itemize? If so, can you find all the documents you need and figure out how much you owe? Did you end up paying more than you should have? Did you get a refund? So, happy April 15th. But if you'd like more time in the spring sunshine, and a little less time fretting over tax returns, next time you hear a politician talking about a VAT, listen up. This week's editor's notebook is entitled Kane's Success on Ice Bodes Well for Raleigh. The first round of the 2019 National Hockey League playoffs already have started, and for the first time since 2009, the Carolina Hurricanes are in. The hockey team, coached by the former captain of the Stanley Cup-winning Canes, is Rob Brind'Amour. They'll likely face the uphill task of dethroning the Washington Capitals, the NHL's reigning champions. Based on the ticket sales of games on April 15 and 18, Shades of 2006 surely will come back, with folks out in the parking lot hours before the start tailgating themselves into a frenzy. But what most people forget during these exciting periods is that it's really good for the city. All the playoff games are nationally televised, and the city will attract media from all corners of the world. After the Hurricanes' 2006 win, some sports economists projected the economic impact of the Stanley Cup run would have been more than $40 million alone. It came in the form of dollars changing hands before, after, and during the stretch of the four different series. The dollars include tickets, hotel rooms, bars, restaurants, car rentals, plane fares, and shopping. I'm not a big believer of economic impact studies and the ripple effect on the community. Almost all the studies are overblown, and the economists who write them often are paid by vendors who use the studies either to get more taxpayer dollars or be involved in a sale. But even if we believe these numbers are bloated, the fact remains the playoffs in Raleigh will have a different energy. Owners of the Backyard Bistro adjacent to the PNC Arena will have a tough time keeping up with the crowd for at least two games in the coming days. And if the Canes are able to stretch out the playoff run, people here are going to spend money. They've been itching to do so for 10 odd years. When it was clear the Hurricanes needed to win some games during the stretch run, the community responded. The team's 78th game of the season against Philadelphia sold 17,833 seats at PNC, the highest of the season since the opening day sellout. The team sold 17,645 tickets for the last home game of the regular season against the New Jersey Devils. When a city hosts the playoffs of any professional sports, it's more than selling tickets. It's an affirmation that the community is willing to show support if the team and its players hold up their end of the bargain. The Canes did just that this year. Now it's our turn. Go Canes! Well, that music means we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be certain to listen next time. I'm Alton Banks, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long till next time. If you have comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138.